Welcome to another exciting episode of NIDS Knowledge, this one being Real Space Strategy Edition. This podcast is produced by the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will inform you about the latest in space strategy and its importance to our national defense. Since the end of the Cold War, thinking about space deterrence at the nuclear threshold has been virtually ignored as unrealistic and unthinkable. However, with the advent of a second, and some say third, nuclear age, where multiple players are now finding renewed utility in thermonuclear weapons coupled with proliferated missile technology and space access, the concepts of space mission assurance and resilience are not sufficient to deter nuclear threshold space deterrence scenarios propagated by great powers or rogue states. In 2017, the Council on Foreign Relations published a contingency planning memorandum, they called it, entitled Dangerous Space Incidents. This memorandum stated that, quote, based on capabilities, intent, and history of malicious or destabilizing behavior, the states most likely to understand and plan for destabilizing actions in space are China, North Korea, and Iran. These states have increasingly used jamming, hacking, spoofing, and lasing of space and terrestrial-based sensor transmitters and data links. In addition to these reversible means of attack against United States critical space infrastructure, China and Russia are fielding capabilities such as direct descent or co-orbital anti-satellite ASAT weaponry to achieve strategic objectives such as counterintervention or anti-access campaigns. It is interesting to note that the Council on Foreign Relations acknowledges another threshold of dangerous attack options, but chose not to assess it: a nuclear space attack, possibly in the form of an electromagnetic pulse event in space. Why did they ignore that? Well, the members of the Council assessed the scenario to be a, quote, outlier that many, quote, U.S. officials consider unrealistic, end quote. During one of my master's programs at a DoD school, I looked into this topic as another threshold of space attack that deterrence and warfighting capabilities should be applied and prepared for. In that case, it was looking at North Korea, who at that time had launched two satellite test beds, potentially, known as KMS-3 and KMS-4, that flew in a low Earth orbit at an altitude capable of creating massive damage to the United States power grid should it have an EMP on board and detonated over the nation's heartland. Despite this being the topic of congressional and presidential study commissions and numerous congressional hearings, the faculty, like the CFR, consider this topic to be, quote, unrealistic, unlikely, and in some professors' views, nutty, if anyone took it seriously at all. Fast forward to today and the old passé Cold War mentality, quote unquote, and fears of nuclear ASAT weapons is back upon us, thanks to the Russian Federation's reported testing of components for a nuclear ASAT system. Since the end of the Cold War, there has been little emphasis on protecting the United States and its critical space infrastructure from an electromagnetic pulse attack from space. That means it is hard to find any recent thinking, studies, or papers about it. Perusing the literature on the subject, one finds very little, if any, current scholarship on the credibility or readiness for such a threat. In recent years, scholars of nuclear age decision-making and strategy, such as Kerry Karchner and Michael S. Gerson, have begun to question the assertion that nuclear use is unrealistic. They argue that the utility of the nuclear weapon is on the rise in military and foreign policies across the world due to a shift in the strategic order they refer to as the Second Nuclear Age. Former OSD policy leader Dave Trachtenberg argues that we are beyond that phase and are in a Third Nuclear Age. Due to this reemergence of the importance of the nuclear weapon by scholars like Karchner, Gerson, and Trachtenberg, should space strategists and scholars reconsider scenarios and potential threats such as electromagnetic pulse from space? The answer is obvious to those interested in securing our nation, its interests, and the survival of its people from attack in any form. The answer is yes. However, we as a country lack the right leadership in the right positions to make the shift in our Space Force posture for conventional space deterrence and warfighting and lower thresholds of attack, much less posturing our critical space infrastructure for nuclear exchanges in space or from space. As Herman Kahn once argued, it is important for our nation's security, preparedness, and survival for us to think and plan for the, quote, unthinkable. Sadly, our response to the intelligence reporting of the Russian nuclear ASAT effort and even the Chinese Fractional Orbital Bombardment System, or FOBS, that can carry nuclear weapons on low-flying hypersonic glide vehicles or on warheads dropped from space, have been less than stellar. Paul Bracton, author of The Second Nuclear Age, states, quote, "The problem facing the world in the second nuclear age is that few people have thought about how atomic weapons reshape strategic rivalries in the world's most contested regions," end quote. His observation is a timely one, as space has been recognized as a contested region of international activity since at least 2011. In one of my past papers, one of the few writing on this topic back in 2018, I argued then and I argue now that with great power politics having returned to prominence in strategic decision-making, strategists and policy leaders include addressing these threats for deterrence and warfighting capability development, not by arms control or kicking the can down the road, hoping it goes away. The Biden administration has responded to the revelation of the Russian ASAT weapons testing and development with such words as, "It's troubling," but have played it down as not a weapon that can be, quote, "used to attack human beings or cause physical destruction here on Earth," end quote. A recent policy paper quoted President Biden as follows. "First of all, there is no nuclear threat to the people of America or anywhere else in the world with what Russia is doing at the moment. Number two, anything that they're doing or they will do relates to satellites in space and damaging those satellites potentially. Number three, there's no evidence that they have made a decision to go forward with doing anything in space either. So what we found out was that there was a capacity to launch a system into space that could theoretically do something that was damaging. Hadn't happened yet, and my hope is that it will not." End quote. That was the president. Vladimir Putin, the leader of Russia, has also denied that such a weapon is being developed, tested, or deployed, and stated that the Russians have, quote, "always been against nuclear weapons in space." Now, a side note of history for those of you interested, this is an interesting quote given that the Outer Space Treaty was already violated by the Russians, then Soviet Union, with the development and deployment of their nuclear-capable fractional orbital bombardment system before the ink even dried on the treaty's ratification documents in 1967. There are many editorials and articles about this in the historical record for many old Air Force leaders and members of Congress. Flash forward back to present day. So first, playing down the threat is unwise and incorrect. As I have found in my own research from 2018 forward, a nuclear detonation would harm Americans and its interests. More on this in a bit. But first, how did we get to such a weak space posture in the first place? Where our declaratory policy is a confusing and imprecise gobbledygook that reads, quote, "Any purposeful interference with or an attack upon the space systems of the United States or its allies that directly affects national rights will be met with a deliberate response at a time, place, manner, and domain of our choosing, if we have to, I guess." Okay, I added that last part. Following the fall of the Soviet Union, space leaders and policymakers concluded that no credible threat existed to the U.S. space enterprise. Throughout the Cold War, the prime threat to U.S. satellite constellations had been Soviet ASAT weapons, lasers, and other nuclear threshold weapon systems such as electromagnetic pulse, or EMPs, deployed on board the FOBs. The FOBs was a hybrid weapon that combined the technology of an intercontinental ballistic missile with longer range and suborbital or fractional orbital flight profiles that provided a means of attacking the United States' early warning network from the south, where there were less radars. This process meant that it would have been possible for the Soviets to detonate an EMP weapon over the United States to burn out its electrically based industrial and command and control infrastructure prior to launching a full nuclear strike. Other more conventional non-terrestrial counterspace weapons, such as co-orbital ASATs, also threatened strategic early warning, command, and control communications of worldwide deployed forces and global positioning system satellites needed for timing signals and precision bombardment. These Soviet-era weapons were being dismantled as the new Russian Federation struggled to rebuild its economic and political systems, while Western nations hoped for its integration into a new globalizing system. As a result, the hope for space becoming a sanctuary from conflict and a global commons for all mankind appeared likely at the time. Assuming the removal of any credible threat in the foreseeable future, space leaders decided that as part of the forced drawdown, it would be advantageous to promote a policy position assuming sanctuary in space. Treaties like the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, Chemical Weapons Convention, and Missile Technology Control Regime, as well as Cold War-era treaties such as the Outer Space Treaty of 1967 again pause, which the Russians have violated all of them, which banned the basing of weapons of mass destruction in space, were postured to be the foundation of a new world order. This new world order would enable all nations to participate in the development of space, lead to rules and norms of responsible behavior, and ensure the use of space for civil, military, or commercial purposes. Moreover, the ultimate goal would be the prevention of the, quote, weaponization of space into perpetuity. Those supporting this move in the national security arena asserted that this posture of norms and sanctuary-based policy would be sufficient to sustain America's space power advantage. Eventually, this concept of strategic thought was labeled strategic restraint. Strategic restraint is a concept that proponents argue will enable a stable, secure environment in space. Such stability would be accomplished by the United States serving as the example and not pursuing any means of self-defense in space, much less any offensive space power capable of seizing control of the, quote, high ground for the benefit of the United States alone. Proponents have argued that if the U.S. were to pursue offensive counter-space capability, the international system in space could be destabilized and the U.S. would be considered an aggressive hegemon. However, this idea would only work in an international system in which every state accepts the rules and bases governance and norms of behavior on a U.S.-led international order. Strategic restraint does not address the potential rise of emergent or revisionist powers, nor the revival of great power politics. Due to the political and economic currents of the day, the strategic restraint view of space strategy prevailed, and terms such as space superiority, preeminence, and dominance either fell out of favor or were widely criticized when proposed as counter-strategies for the future. One example of this view is the Atlantic Council's report from 2016, which argued that strategic restraint has begun to unravel and that strategic restraint is still required to, quote, rebalance the space environment away from a U.S. advantage. In its place, a term that seems interchangeable with space superiority but is in fact quite different came into use, space security. Despite its martial sound, space security is not about national security or achieving national strategic interests. Space security is defined by the Space Security Index of Plowshares as the secure and sustainable access to and use of space and freedom from space-based threats. Its adherents argue that this focus is not based on, quote, the interests of particular national or commercial entities, but the security and, keyword, sustainability of outer space as an environment, end quote. Space security is a concept that combines environmental concerns pertaining to debris generation with arms control advocacy. Its objectives are to ensure that conventional space weapons, those not yet banned by international treaty, are never deployed by the United States or its allies. Throughout the 1990s and early 2000s, America's use of U.S. space systems such as GPS and commercial satellite communications grew exponentially until American society as well as the armed forces became dependent upon them for day-to-day life. In addition, national sectors such as banking, finance, agriculture, and energy became interdependent upon critical space infrastructure. Due to the perceived low-threat future and the transition from deterrence via nuclear weapons to conventional deterrence and coercion, the United States decided to not invest in hardening the nation's terrestrial infrastructure or its space-based enablers from the dangers of EMP or lower-threshold space attacks. Rising revisionist powers such as China noticed the successful use of formerly, quote, strategic space support capabilities in the 1991 Persian Gulf War and its greater integration into American and Western society. These states found space power to have become the United States, quote, soft ribs, vulnerable enough for a rising power to target for its counterintervention or future expansionist strategies. By 2000, it appeared to Congress and the Defense Department that interstate espionage and technological information theft by China and others gave Congress great concerns that the new, more globalized order was not being as effectively implemented for space power and national security strategy as expected. As a result, Congress convened a commission to investigate the future posture needed to protect the advantages that space provided the United States and its allies. Known as the Rumsfeld Commission, it concluded that a period of harmony between states and space was over, and a new era of space had begun. China began to engage in the first stages of its lawfare program against the potential revival of space superiority programs in the United States. These efforts were, quote, attempts to restrict U.S. space activities through international regulations, end quote, and treaties. In addition, new Chinese anti-satellite weapons programs were being pursued in tandem with these lawfare activities. Despite these warning signs, the Rumsfeld Commission's final report underscored that, quote, evaluation of the threat to U.S. space capabilities currently lacks priority in the competition for collection and analytic resources, end quote. This lack of attention toward the critical space infrastructure of the United States, quote, could leave the U.S. vulnerable to surprises in space that could result in deferred decisions on developing space-based capabilities, meaning weapons, due to the lack of a validated, well-understood threat, end quote. The Space Commission report was one of the first to notice that the concept of, quote, mutual vulnerability was not mutual at all, and instead was offering an inviting target that very well could lead to the U.S. facing what the Chinese term a grave aftermath. The Commission recommended that the Department of Defense acquire and develop space forces that could be employed in independent operations or in support of air, land, and sea forces to deter and defend against attacks. This recommendation for space forces meant the development of a space corps and possibly an independent military department for space, but in the near term, the Rumsfeld Commission viewed the development of space forces to achieve space superiority and active defenses as a required act. Most of the recommendations by this commission and others later in the decade were never implemented, and those that were, such as the creation of a DoD Intelligence Community National Security Space Office to coordinate all these actions, were eventually reversed and discontinued by Air Force and intelligence community leaders. Following the 2007 kinetic ASAT test by the Chinese, it became clear to many in government that the time had come to acknowledge that space was quickly moving away from a sanctuary to a more contested environment. Due to this awareness, the George W. Bush administration in 2006's national space policy recognized, quote, those who effectively utilize space will enjoy added prosperity and security and will hold a substantial advantage over those who do not, end quote. The Bush administration decided that freedom of action in space is as important to the United States as air power and sea power, and therefore the United States must have robust, effective, and efficient space capabilities, weapons, to deter others from impeding those rights or developing capabilities intended to do so, take those actions necessary to protect its space capabilities, respond to interference, and deny, if necessary, adversaries the use of space capabilities hostile to U.S. national interests. Authors and commentators invested in globalization and space security ideology began to assert that the Chinese and Russian government's rationale for development of counter-space weapons systems was the fault of the 2006 policy's imperialist rhetoric about space, which to them was seen as a global common, the inheritance of all mankind. These comments failed, however, to acknowledge that Chinese and Russian counterspace programs had been ongoing since the early 1990s, if not before, despite the adherence of strategic restraint and the U.S. no longer pursuing active counterspace programs. By the Obama administration, starting in 2009, they halted the policy of the Bush administration and space policy reverted to the international approach of a rules-based norms of behavior strategic restraint. Strategic restraint as a policy was thus resuscitated as a national policy. Later on, during the Trump administration, there was a quick attempt to reverse some of this in their national strategy for space, but its lack of full implementation by the Defense Department in its Defense Space Strategy of 2020 meant that space security and strategic restraint, views of space policy and defense posturing, would continue despite the intelligence community's public documents showing the rapid development of Chinese and Russian space weapons systems and the vulnerability of our space systems continuing to grow. To make matters worse, the current administration's efforts to proactively ban kinetic ASAT testing and other items while Russia and China veto such efforts at the UN indicate not only a weak military posture, but a diplomatic effort that has seen better days. The Chinese and Russians don't really care what the international community thinks. What they care about is pursuing the power necessary to displace the U.S. as the leader of the world order and to do so through robust space weapons capabilities for both psychological, as in win without fighting, and physical, restoring Chinese and Russian territorial influence abroad by force if necessary. Chinese and Russian aggression in the South China Sea and in Eastern Europe and the Middle East, respectively, not to mention its aggressive space activities, as have been reported, finally I might add, in the press, indicate that we are not dealing with a passive international law-abiding one nation among many, but an allied partnership for destabilization and conflict upon the United States and the world. So what should the United States do? First, stop playing down the threat. Stop saying things to the public that aren't true, like there would be no destruction or harm to the American people from such a weapon, the nuclear ASAT. If a nuclear attack in space happens in low Earth orbit, as the weapon is supposedly designed for, electromagnetic pulse will be something that will hurt the people on terra firma, not just spacecraft in orbit. An EMP, for those of you wondering, is defined as the interaction of high-energy nuclear radiation with the atoms of the atmosphere, causing damaging surges of electric power. When a nuclear explosion occurs at high altitude or in space, the EMP signal it produces will cover the wide geographic region within the line of sight of the detonation. This EMP capability can produce widespread and long-lasting disruption and damage to the critical infrastructure that underpin the fabric of U.S. society. In testimony before a congressional committee on the topic of EMP, Gary Smith of Johns Hopkins University stated that the effect of such an attack can be continental in scope. Continent-wide damage is possible because a detonation at an altitude of 500 kilometers means the entire continental United States, as well as parts of Canada and Mexico, and vital parts of our critical space infrastructure in orbit would be impacted by such a strike. Lowell Wood, also of Johns Hopkins University, previously described the potential impact of EMP before a hearing of the House Armed Services Committee several years ago. He said, quote, "We essentially move the United States back in time by about one century, and you live like our grandfathers and great-grandfathers did in the 1890s and early 1900s until you rebuild. You do without telephones, you do without television, and you do without electric power. And if it happens that there is not enough fuel to heat with in the wintertime, and there is not enough food to go around because agriculture has become so inefficient and so on, the population simply shrinks to meet the carrying capacity of the system." This assessment led the EMP Commission, created by Congress, to assert that a high-altitude or spaceborne EMP strike upon the homeland could lead to many deaths over a short period of time. Commission member Ambassador Henry Cooper testified, quote, "We do not have experience with losing the infrastructure in a country with 300 million people, most of whom don't live in a way that provides for their own food and other needs. As a result of this lack of data, and given our technology-dependent society and the population presently considered, it appears 10% or 30 million people would probably be the range where we could survive as a basically rural economy." The threat of an EMP strike from high altitudes or in orbital space, taking the United States back over a century to a rural society, may seem far-fetched, but this is not just considered likely by security-focused groups and think tanks, but also by studies conducted within the arms control community. This agreement, by seemingly disparate agendas, provides additional weight to the concerns regarding this threat. In the early 21st century, most national economies are heavily dependent upon infrastructure, both terrestrial and space-based, that rely on electricity and electronics. These infrastructures are interdependent and overlapping, creating a situation where even a localized impact in one or more urban areas could have tremendous negative consequences. An EMP explosion in or near an urban area or on a continental scale has the capability to produce widespread and long-lasting disruption and damage to critical infrastructure, creating the possibility of long-term catastrophic consequences. It could not only seriously degrade or shut down a large part of the electric power grid in the geographic area of EMP exposure near instantaneously, it could also lead to functional collapse of grids beyond the exposed area as electrical effects propagate from one region to another. When cut off from the communication, financial, and other society-supporting functions provided through critical space infrastructure and those terrestrial dependent upon electrical grids, emergency response efforts are jeopardized and fuel reserves for backup systems and stocks of food and medicine will quickly be exhausted. The maintenance of a reasonable standard of health will not be possible without the rapid recovery of the economic critical industries. Prolonged disruption of these systems puts the survival of the population and the prospect of economic recovery into question. Experts now say that the use of a fractional orbital bombardment system, FOBS, to execute an EMP strike upon the United States critical infrastructure by North Korea, China, or an ASAT by Russia is more likely than a standard ICBM strike because such an attack does not require an accurate guidance system because the area of effect, having a radius of hundreds or thousands of kilometers, is so large. No reentry vehicle is needed because the warhead is detonated above the atmosphere. This accessibility to technology for EMP from space makes for a very serious situation should a nation not deterred by traditional methods of deterrence and coercion gain the capability to employ such technology. North Korea could be one of those, for example. Given the technological development of China and Russian satellite-based nuclear ASATs are not out of the realm of the possible, and Chinese and Russia's proactive attack to deter models and escalate to de-escalate operational concepts flies in the face of the diplomatic approach arguing that such activities as the orbital ASAT recently revealed by the U.S. interim ambassador at the UN this past week, or the nuclear ASAT reported in the press a few months ago, indicate that while the Chinese and Russians state one thing, we promote peace in space, nuclear weapons in space are bad, their actions now and throughout history are not predisposed to treaty compliance but breach. They're not passive but aggressive. And as nuclear weapons become more and more seen as a utility for gaining strength in contested domains like space and on Earth, the time when this threat is seen as unlikely or unthinkable has passed. Secondly, we must posture ourselves for space deterrence and warfighting environment that could realistically go in a nuclear direction despite our best efforts to thwart it. I have written in the past and continue to believe that the best strategy for addressing the multi-layered defense architecture or attack architecture of space weapons from reversible to irreversible, kinetic, non-kinetic, and even nuclear attack requires a flexible and armed space force. I refer to it as the tiered tailored strategic framework that should be created. This framework is designed to provide a tool for the space strategist and policymaker to assess potential adversaries' decision-making calculus and provide a greater foundational understanding of why the adversary is pursuing its space power force projection capabilities through their view of themselves, space deterrence, and strategy, and then pair that understanding with the cognitive, with the physical use of force as required. Whether in my book Reversing the Tao, which studies the military strategic culture of China as the threat, or my follow-on, Deterring the Unthinkable, which looks at the Tier 1 or nuclear space nexus-type threat of North Korean EMP, the point is that while weapons, real damage-creating weapons, are key to deterrence credibility, skipping the step of analysis of the adversary's intentions and worldview is one that cannot be ignored, unless you want the nation to fail in deterrence and or the war that might follow. Given the stakes to our survival as a nation and a space power leader, mentioned earlier by the threat of Russian nuclear ASATs and Chinese nuclear FOBs, this is a no-brainer. Resiliency is not a deterrent. Test bans ignored by Russia and China are ineffective. Having a passive, small, and weak space force equipped with insufficient capabilities, even on the low-threshold electronic warfare side, much less the equipment needed for high-threshold and nuclear sides of the threats, shows we have much work to do in very little time. In fact, we have wasted the last 20 years despite all the evidence pointing away from a peace dividend or a peaceful rise of China. We must have the kinetic ASAT capabilities that can be used in a multi-role space defense option of intercepting and destroying nuclear or other such ASAT threats that could pose EMP hazards to our orbital critical space infrastructure and our economy. We must be willing to acknowledge who the enemy is and that it's not one that we would prefer or one that is easy. It requires, as Therese Delpech, the noted French strategic analyst, and even Cold War theorist American Bernard Brody, that we as a nation must be willing to do things we find horrible in order to deter and prevent those things that are much worse at the hands of a determined nuclear-armed enemy in space. This requires an armed space force, not a space support force, and we need it yesterday. As we explore these topics and others in the future, there will be a lot more detail to go, but for now, this is Christopher Stone for Real Space Strategy. Thanks for listening. Thank you for listening to NIDS Knowledge, Real Space Strategy. The Real Space Strategy edition is produced under NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, NIDS. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent on donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I want to thank our producer, Kimberly Sherrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative NIDS Knowledge.